free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, see our past lineup of speakers and see who we have coming up, and see some phone numbers if you desire to phone in if you're listening live. This is March 3rd, 2008, and we have as our guest today Dr. Mike Mitchell Swartz of Jet Thermal Products. It's a company that is in process of developing what is typically known as cold fusion. It's a technology that they're bringing to the point that it could be brought to market. They're pushing in that direction. He uses the more scientifically accurate terminology of lattice-assisted nuclear reactions, or LANR, to describe their work. Dr. Swartz received his Bachelor and Master's of Science in Electrical Engineering degrees from MIT, and he received a Doctorate of Medicine from Harvard in 1978, followed by a doctorate in science from MIT in 1984. He founded Jet Energy, which has developed high impedance and co-dispositional fusers, optimal operating point control, multi-ring calorimetry with thermal waveform reconstruction, and other quality control procedures used in calorimetric. Sorry, that word is not fresh in my mind. Analysis and the material fabrication of lattice-assisted nuclear reactions, LANR, devices. His specialties include the interaction of radiation and matter, antenna, phototherapies involving electron transfer, high-dose multifractionated photoradiotherapy, biological semiconductor sensors, and positron emission tomography. His clinical interests are radiation oncology and biomedical engineering, diagnostic and treatment devices, and the development of artificial internal organs and therapy systems powered by the lattice-assisted nuclear reactions, or cold fusion. Now that is quite a mouthful for most of us to comprehend. Clearly, Dr. Swartz has a robust academic background, bringing a high degree of credibility to his work in a field that most of us simply prefer to refer to as cold fusion. Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sterling. Thank you for inviting me.
You're certainly welcome. Now, that was a big mouthful for me, and I imagine most of our audience, it's a lot of terms that are new but vaguely familiar. So you're on the show to kind of help us flesh that out as to what all that stuff was about. Before we get into discussion of your company's technology in particular, I was hoping that we could devote the first half of this show to an overview of the cold fusion field in general, or lattice-assisted nuclear reactions, as you call it. I've also seen it called low-energy nuclear reactions, or LENR, as well as chemically-assisted nuclear reactions, or CANR. Maybe you could start out by explaining what is meant by each of those terms and what they entail in lay terms.
That's a lot. I'll try, though. Cold fusion, obviously, you could describe best because it came out from where you are in Utah. Right now, I'm speaking to you from west of Boston, and it's 42 degrees here. The sky's 80% cloudy. And what cold fusion offers is incredibly clean energy, very efficient, very clean. And if you remember flashback to 1989, when Fleischmann and Pons and others in Utah began talking about cold fusion, that was the same time that the The thing is, it's incredibly clean, and that's why it's so important. And what cold fusion is the mixing of an alloy with heavy hydrogen to make helium in very tiny amounts. And so what happens is that the helium is environmentally safe. It's the same thing that we put in balloons at parades, and it offers the opportunity to make Kyoto moot. And that's why it's so important, is that a city now that needs a energy of a gigawatt per day today has to burn and create 30,000 tons of CO2, 600 tons of SO2, 80 tons of nitrogen dioxide. And if we could get cold fusion to work, it would only produce 4 pounds of helium-4. So that's why it's so important. Now, what lattice-assisted nuclear reactions are a slight variant of cold fusion. What I was trying to remember was the Exxon Valdez. That's what crashed up in Alaska at the same time that Fleischmann and Pons made their announcement.
Mm-hmm.
Lattice-assisted nuclear reactions involve a flux of the deuterium through the metal so that it's slightly different from where the people in 1989 were pointing. For example, in 1989, everyone was talking about fusion by electrolysis. But in fact, to do the flux, it's 1 minus electrolysis. It's everything where people were looking. This was in a slightly different place. So as regards low-energy nuclear reactions, I think that's, in my opinion, a misstatement, because if it was low energy, why look anyway? And the energies involved are 20 million EV, which is actually fairly large. So I think that's a misnomer. I like lattice-assisted nuclear reactions because it explains why you need the material loaded and explains a little bit about new places to look for this type of alternative energy.
Now, cold fusion has gotten a bad rap over the years. I know, especially because being here in Utah when all this stuff broke out, it kind of got the brunt of all that negative publicity that followed. You were describing how clean this energy would be. That's why it took off and got people's imagination stirred. And it seems like it was a little bit of a misfiring. And since that time, though, there have been a lot of successful replication, hundreds of replications of that effect, and a number of variations that have been discovered. A lot of scientific conferences have been held annually ever since then. So it's not that there's nothing there, but, I mean, what happened? Why is cold fusion still being overlooked, even though it has been proven over and over again?
I'm not sure it's being overlooked. I think there are people of dedicated researchers who continue to examine it, some continuously, some intermittently, and I think that the engineering of the field has developed. I mean, at Jet Energy, we're looking at fourth, fifth generational devices, which we'll talk more about later. I think that people missed it for several reasons. One reason are those reasons which include strawman arguments. That is, the skeptic would say, well, it doesn't produce neutrons, it can't be real. And there, we could discuss that. Or they would say, there's no penetrating ionizing radiation, all the graduate students are alive and they should be dead, therefore it's not real. Or they would say, incorrectly, it's not reproducible, therefore it's not real. And then there are the physical reasons why people had a hard time reproducing it, which was it takes an inordinate length of time to run the experiment. Many people didn't have the patience. It takes understanding that you have to make a binary alloy and get a loading ratio of at least 80%, and very few people back in 89 either understood that or got much beyond about 40%. There's the issue of optimal operating points, which we found out and have reported on, where if you miss them, your device or system will not give excess heat. And finally, there's the issues of flux, which we've described in the quasi one-dimensional model, which also generated optimum operating points, co-deposition, control of heat after death, that is yet another reason why people may have missed it. So I think there are several reasons, and I think in your own state there were other reasons of competition and that you can explain better.
Yeah, there's also Mr. Jones, Stephen Jones, also the 911 fame, who was about to publish on this in Pons and Fleischmann, wanted to beat him to it, so they preempted his publication, and what had happened is it went public before it went peer adequately, and I think that may have been part of the misfiring, so to speak.
Well, a lot of things happened that year, and I think that the science wasn't the number one issue. And it should have been. And luckily, in the 19 years that have followed, there have been people that have persevered and looked at the science and engineering. And that gets us to what goes on today. As you correctly mentioned, in the community, there are typically 2 to 3 meetings per year in the United States, and there is international meetings every year. What we find now is that when cold fusion was first announced, the power densities that Fleischmann and Pons reported were in the range of 7 watts per cubic centimeter. By the mid-90s, that had increased to 70 to 100. And there are reports in excess of 1,000 watts per cubic centimeter. And that's important because the baseline that you compare it to are nuclear fuel rods, which are on the order of 100 or hundreds of watts per cubic cm. The other things that are going on recently are that I think skeptics are taking a second look. I think what's happened is we've seen a lot of these revolutionary technologies confirmed by jet energy. We've given public demos. Others have, like John Dash. The U.S. Navy has given reports about the existence of this. There have been worldwide experimental and developmental reports that what we're dealing with is a metallic lattice that we end up filling, like a sponge fills with water. And here what we're doing is we're filling up the palladium with heavy hydrogen. And the result of that is that it takes a certain amount of energy to fill it, but the amount of heat that comes out exceeds what we put in, and that's called excess energy. And that's really interesting because compared to an ohmic resistor, what we get out is about 2 or 3 times what we put in.
And that's where it's at now?
Well, where it's at now is we have been developing ways of coupling using heavy hydrogen as a fuel, using helium-4 as the product, taking this cutting-edge technology and coupling it to small model home heaters and small propulsion devices. And the reason we think it's so important is because not only do we get an ultra-high efficiency, but if we can get this to work on larger scale and do an impedance match, it's free of pollution and free of toxic emissions.
I'm going to throw in a tangent question here, and that is, there's a field that is developing where they're using electrolysis to generate hydrogen super efficiently using pulse electromagnetic input. Stanley Myers was one of the pioneers in that field, and there are gobs of people chasing that one. Is it possible that they may be seeing some cold fusion in some of the more efficient reactions?
I don't know. I think that we have to learn from others and learn that we don't understand everything. And so, you know, I wish them well. I don't know.
One of the things that happened a couple of years ago, there was a review by the Department of Energy. It was a second review on cold fusion. If I remember right, it kind of came out, it wasn't negative, but it was kind of lukewarm, saying, well, it exists, but it's not going to be heating anyone's coffee anytime soon, was sort of the upshot of that. Maybe you could comment on that.
I think it's much bigger than that. Initially, the EREV report in 1989 ended coal fusion. And for whatever argument you can make of how it was formulated or misformulated, it did it. But what happened in 2003 at ICC F10, which was one of these international meetings that we had at MIT and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was that there were two open demos. We did ours open for 5 days, and John Dash did his as well of coal fusion. Hundreds of people came. And as a result of the open demo and the excitement of probably 90 papers over 5 days, many of which were in excellent quality, Peter Hagelstein, Dave Nagel, and others went to the DOE, and the idea of coal fusion was reconsidered. Now, obviously there was sampling because 18 people were chosen, or whatever the number were, to investigate. And what is interesting is, one, the DOE's conclusions were there were two areas where they recommended additional research could help. And they had ideas about alloying and dislocations. I mean, that's a big difference from the 1989 AREV report, where one would say it doesn't exist. And second of all, if you read what was going on, I think two-thirds of the people who looked at it believed that there might be something to it. And even though a large, significant fraction were pretty sure that the people in front of them didn't have the data that they needed to fully believe in it. And I think that's a massive change. And it really has changed the field, just as some of our demonstrations, which we've had with the DITRA and with the Navy over the last couple of years. And as a result of that, the U.S. government entertained ideas and solicitations on coal fusion as of June of this last year. And so I see that's a massive change, at least from where I sit, my parallax view.
You mentioned something earlier about the smoking gun, so to speak, of, you know, what is the proof that LANR and cold fusion are nuclear. Maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on that.
There's a lot of reasons that are suggestive, and some that were take-home-to-the-bank reasons. So, for example, we see an excess heat that is a heat beyond what you would see when you put the same current into an ohmic resistor that you might take out of an old television set. And its magnitude is greater than what we could calculate for all chemical origin in something of that volume. And also we see negligible changes of the electrodes. No substantial changes in the reactants except for loss of water by evaporation. No significant products by corrosion or flocculation or deposition. And that goes on for thousands of hours. So the only thing left, when you rule out the improbable, is nuclear. That's suggestive. Now there's other reasons. We see critical thresholds. We see superlinear behavior. We see changes in time course that we think is consistent. But I think the one that really takes it home is the work of Mel Miles and his team from the U.S. Navy when they were at China Lake. And what they found was, and you have to do this in metal flasks, so So you got to give him a lot of credit for having taken the meticulous time to have run these cold fusion experiments in containers of metal to keep helium in the air out. And what he found was, when he got excess heat, he got de novo production of a commensurate amount of helium-4. Now that is, in those metal flasks, absolutely incredible. Because what was learned from that was, for every 10 to the 12th helium atoms that are created, we get 1 joule of excess energy. And that told us what the product was. It showed us that it was nuclear. And I think Mel Miles has got to be congratulated for having shown that that was of nuclear origin.
So have you seen reproducible equations coming out? You just gave one, for example, for every 10 to the 12th helium created, that amounts to 1 joule of excess energy. Are you starting to formulate equations that are quantifying this reaction?
We see three theories that really help us understand and have helped us design equipment in this field. One is the quasi-one-dimensional model of loading, and that's totally different from electrochemistry. In electrochemistry, what's done is to use the Nernst equation and assume the system is at equilibrium. We don't. And also, by the way, in the Nernst system, which was proposed by Faraday and all of those after them, what you do is you assume the system is at equilibrium, and then you use activity coefficients to make everything come out correctly. We don't need activity coefficients. And what we do is what's called continuum electromechanics. It gave rise to motors. It gave rise to all kinds of things. And we use diffusivity, electrophoretic mobility, concentration. When you do it that way, you get an answer which I think is superior because you don't have to assume equilibrium. And I'm pretty sure that in these desired reactions, there may not be equilibrium. So one of the things that have helped us is the quasi-one-dimensional model of loading, which also teaches us how to get the flux into the metal. Another thing which helped us is the CAM theory, the catastrophic active medium theory. What happens is once you load the metal, if you have local heating, it depopulates of the heavy hydrogen. There's flux that goes to Frenkel defects. It's well beyond the level of this call. But what happens is the result of these catastrophic actions in the metal, which have been confirmed, is that we drive the deuterons together and we make an excited state of helium. And what happens then is our last theory, which seems to help, is the fuson theory, not to be confused with the fusors, which are the devices that we use to get the reactions. The fuson theory tells us how the 20 million electron volts in the excited state of helium can be dissipated to the lattice, because that's what makes cold fusion or lattice-assisted nuclear reactions so different from what was expected. People really were not prepared in 1989 for the fact that the lattice changes the ability of these things to react in such a way that you do get the final product, the helium-4.
Now, isn't the emergence of helium-4 measurable and evidence of nuclear?
Yeah, I think it is. The fact is not only did they find that, but the excess heat is proportional. What I discovered was, if you take their data and plot it as a function of input power, you get these things called optimal operating points. I had discovered with Gail Werner that there are these things called optimal operating points. These are peaks in behavior where if you drive the system at that point, you get peak production. And they're very narrow. If you're too far on one side, you're wasting energy and you're not going to get the excess heat. And on the other side, you got insufficient loading. You're not going to ever get the excess heat. It's not going to work. These are important things. Go ahead.
Yeah. We've done this overview of the cold fusion in general, One of the terms that we've not addressed before we go and talk about your company in particular, one of the terms that is used for cold fusion is chemical assisted, is it?
Well, you got to talk to the people that formulated. They have chemical assisted nuclear reaction. It's not chemistry, it's lattice. If it was chemistry, we would have seen it before. It's not low energy because it's 20 million electron volts. Right? That's not low energy. It's high energy.
So,
20
so
million electron volts. We could use in radiotherapy. It would treat a tumor and it would leave the skin intact. The person would never get erythema. That's high energy. It's in the pure production region. Not low
so
energy.
So are you arguing to the
And it's not chemistry because it's a lattice. What this is close to is Mossbauer effect. It's the fact that in the case of Mossbauer, what he discovered was that the S orbitals are non-zero right at the nucleus, and you can get interactions to the lattice. Here again, in the case of cold fusion, or better yet, when it's correctly done, in the case of lattice-assisted nuclear reactions, when you have that flux through the metal, when you've waited the adequate amount of time, when you have the other things that we also need, when you have the right amount of loading, then you get the excess heat. And we're able to measure the activation energy, we're able to measure the excess heat, we're able to measure the heat after death. And with some of these technologies that we've got, like the quasi one-dimensional model and optimal operating control, we've learned how to maximize heat after death, which I better define that term. It's heat after death was a bad term coined by Stanley Pons, dealing with the fact when one of their cells ran out of heavy water, thereby making the circuit open circuit, they kept getting excess heat. They call that heat after death. What it is once you activate the desired reactions and cut off the electrical input, under some conditions, these reactions continue. And we're at the point now where we see different time constants because different populations are involved within the metal. We're able to see quite a bit now that people could not even dream about in 89.
It seems to me, after your descriptions, and you've described the evolution of the science since the 19 years ago, Pons and Fleischmann coming up here on March 23rd was their announcement, that perhaps what we had was kids playing in the gun closet type of phenomenon where people, it was just a bit over the heads of present understanding of physics, and it's taken all this time to kind of wrap our heads around it to the point where we can now adequately describe well enough what's going on that science can start paying more close attention.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think the skeptics could have accepted this earlier because the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The fact is that some people did get neutrons. And the fact is that if they really looked at the energy levels, they would have seen that neutron emission was 1 MeV above the excited state and at room temperature, which I think is about 25th of an electron volt, you're never going to get that amount of energy. Another thing that they were totally dead-bang wrong about was that a graduate student problem. They claimed there had to be penetrating ionizing radiation. And yet when we looked at it and published on the change in Bremsstrahlung, what happens is that the forward radiation falls by a factor of 10 to the 19th, and the radiation changes from penetrating ionizing to the infrared, where it's skin depth locked. Again, if they just looked at the equations, they might have stopped persecuting all the people that were looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, there's the issue of reproducibility, which is the whole problem here is that in the case of other fields, when you say it's non-reproducible, in the case of cancer treatment, in the case of meteorology, in the case of earthquakes and lightning and sunstops and solar storms, and it's not the same term. Here what it means is they're trying to say that it's bad science, that it's a euphemism, that it's wrong. And yet if they looked at it, they would see, one, that the equations and the physics out there now is really enough to handle cold fusion, and they should have just looked at it more.
And back to what you were saying earlier, where you were describing your terminology, lattice-assisted nuclear reactions. Are you trying to argue to the field in general that that's the most accurate description that should be used by the cold fusion scientific field?
Well, I think it's more descriptive.
Okay. Well, now that we've done this overview of cold fusion, let's get into particular in terms of talking about your company. Give us a thumbnail view of your company, its objectives, how does it work. And when I was introducing you, I used a lot of terminology that's going to be vaguely familiar to us. Maybe you could explain briefly from that description what those various terms mean and how your company is pursuing cold fusion and what you're doing with it.
Okay. If they want to see a picture, they can go to your website and see what a fusor looks like. That
it
looks like a
kind
filament.
It resembles a spine, a spinal
pardon?
Column.
I beg your pardon?
I'm saying the picture resembles a spinal column, a section of the spine.
I've seen a lot of spines, and I don't think so. But we'll...
Anyway, go ahead.
I would say it looks close like a spiral. I'm not sure it looks like a spine, but okay. You do make it quite available. Again, what our thumbnail is, we have heavy hydrogen as fuel. It's been shown by the U.S. Navy that it can be converted in tiny amounts to save clean helium. And our goal is with these fourth and third and fourth generation devices to figure out how to heat larger volumes and how to heat bigger propulsion devices.
When you say third and fourth generation, you're saying that there was a working prototype that would be the first generation. The second generation would be an improvement on that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For example, in our open demo at MIT back in 2003, we've had many, many improvements since that time. I mean, we have our drivers are improved, our fusors are improved, our excess heats have increased.
So what do you mean by third and fourth generation? What does that terminology mean?
When we made our first devices in 1989, I would call that first generation. And now, for example, without really getting into all of it, we have motors that couple. We have redundant systems where when we measure excess heat, we measure it with calorimetry. We measure it with input power normalized delta T. We measure it with input power normalized production of electricity. We measure it with paired and engines. And we measure it against calibrated controls, where we also do the waveform reconstruction and noise measurement.
Okay. And what are these devices doing, and where are they in the process of making it to market, where there's something that people can buy off the shelf?
Right now, we have demos. We've shown it to some people what we have, and I don't think we're ready for market to the people yet. I mean, basically, we've done research over two decades, and over that time, I think that we've shown fairly good reproducibility. We're learning how to control the behavior. I mean, it's probably, for the time being, until we get longer handles on mean time to failure and other issues, I'm real happy with what we have. I mean, we've developed co-deposition fusors, high impedance fusors. We've developed time-integrated measurements with multi-ring calorimetric systems and all the controls. And with the control of optimal operating point behavior, which if we had time we could talk about. And by the way, that is such an incredibly powerful technique, because one of the things we have today is there are many, many kinds of cold fusion. The Chinese, the Japanese, the Russians, the Italians, they're all looking at different types. Yet the one thing, and there are many people in this country who are doing really good work, yet the one thing that we find is that all of them, even though they may be disparate in how they set it up, is that that's one technology that really helps them all. Because when they drive their systems at that input power at the peak, then when they're off peak, I mean, we really see a major performance loss.
So all of them have that narrow window of performance?
Yep. And what's most interesting to me is when they have had that window of performance, it is coupled between the excess heat and production of helium-4. So we see that both, for example, in the Miles work at China Lake, where we see what looks like a Gaussian in excess heat along the input power axis, and there's a matched Gaussian with the production of de novo helium-4 in those metal flasks we so briefly talked about, yet it took him quite much more time to laboriously do that work. And so what happens is a Rotter the same way, and yet he has a different system. He uses palladium black, and he uses it in a dual compartment system, and yet there too we see these incredibly sharp optimal operating points, and we see them matched for the production of helium-4 and heat.
Now, when you talk about a narrow window of optimal performance, it probably means the cold fusion, once it becomes robust enough in its reproducibility and control, that it will be an on or off type of technology. It's not something you could ramp, you could govern up and down to run a car, for example, but it would be more for a power plant that you turn it on and it's set to a certain level and you keep it at that level and you don't, ramp, gauge it up or gauge it down. Is that correct?
I'm more optimistic. I think we will use it for cars and planes and propulsion devices. And the optimal operating points we find, which explains, I mean, right now we do use it in systems with small model engines, including small model cars. I do believe that it's not just power systems. We'll be able to, and here's the proof. If you found a bicycle, a bicycle with 20 gears, or a very large lorry or truck with 10 gears, and you didn't know how to run it, you may not be able to start it well if you didn't know to go to first and second, third. That's what this is. And in fact, I think that those people who have access to the optimal operating point will find that they have improved operation, more product output. And also recently we've learned we can control the outputs. And that's one of the things we recently showed at the MIT colloquium.
So it's just a matter of keeping it in that narrow window of performance by gauging the input parameters appropriately to give you the output that you want.
Exactly so.
Okay, so it is governable in terms of the net energy output.
We think it is. We think it is. In fact, we think that there's several ones. We reported at ICCF 10 that there's a second group of loci for power output if you're making a performance engine, because that's where we first started talking about engines and electricity production publicly. Now we do it more.
Now, when you talk about this application in cars, planes, what is the infrastructure going to look like? Is it going to be heat turning in a Stirling engine? How are you going to interface it?
I think that's what I look at now, one of the ways we look, the other way we look are advanced thermoelectrics. Some of the discoveries there, some have not been announced, some have. People claim they get higher efficiencies. We're willing to look. Our goal is to look at higher temperatures, higher powers.
Would this ever have application to jet engines, which is a second question, is why do you call your company Jet Energy, where you have propulsion going out one end, driving the machine in the other direction?
It dates back to earlier reasons than energy. Jet actually dates back to earlier reasons and for different things. The important thing now is that we may have a way of getting an ultra-clean, ultra-efficient way of alternative energy that should have been given Manhattan-level emphasis decades ago when people where you are at in Utah first started thinking about it. And we didn't see that, and that's what we need.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the momentum building toward that kind of interest?
Well, it's like melting ice, you know, that's a phase change. So I see the change because I see the funding starting to trickle down. I see that some of the skeptics have joined in and have begun advancing the field. I think that there's still a lag with publications. It's very hard to get things published in the field. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And the other thing is there aren't enough people, and that's what probably hurts the most. And we've talked about it for 19 years, and the fact is there are too few people.
Well, on your website, you list about 40 papers that you've published. I imagine those are in more non-mainstream journals. You run a journal yourself, Cold Fusion Times.
Right. I mainly cover other people's technology in it. We had 12 good years. We took a year off. We're thinking about coming back and bringing it out again. There have been several Cold Fusion magazines. One of the first ones was by your Hal Fox out in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And Russ George had one of the firsts. I think we had the third. And we were there for 12 years. We covered all kinds of things in the field, generally not mine. And as I say, what I ended up publishing in, and we at Jet, was Fusion Technology, which was a hot fusion magazine. And I like that because I like difficult reviewers. And I think it helps the paper. So that's where we tended to publish, and the other ones was the Journal of Journal of Fusion Energy, I think, which was put out by Hal Fox. And the other place that we publish, of course, is the International Meetings, which comes out with a yearly book. And it is unfortunate. I think that's the thing that's most lagging in keeping back more people in the field. But you're helping. You're here to change all that.
Yeah, well, we're all working together on this, trying to bring those technologies that are deserving the attention they deserve, and hopefully it's followed by funding and additional people getting involved, young students getting interested in devoting their life's work to this area. So there's a lot that can be done, and really appreciate the work that you guys are doing. I'm curious, you talked about a five-day demonstration that you did. That was at MIT, right?
Yes, and if people want to see the websites, we have two. The Cold Fusion Times website, just go to Google. Cold Fusion Times is three words, and if you put a quote on both sides, we're either number two or number three. And the other company is Jet Thermal Products. And what you'll find is the Jet Thermal Product demo ran for 5 days at MIT, and people wrote about it. And we actually kept that system going for a little more than a year, And in that interval time, Brian Josephson came to visit from England, and as did scores and scores of other people as it ran. So it's we look at validation as the ability to survive peer review with the hot fusion community by doing open demonstrations and by showing our devices running with full controls to engineers, scientists, journalists in the field. And we've been doing that for the entire interval.
So over a year you were having it run continuously without turning it off, or?
No, it was intermittent. But it, for example, at MIT, we actually brought it to MIT to show the optimal operating point. There were two reasons we brought it to MIT. One was to see if it was portable, and two, to see could we teach hundreds of people what an optimal operating point was. That is, by varying the input power by 100 milliwatts each way over the course of a couple of hours, could we bring the excess heat down and back up? And we did. And so what happened was we had excess heats of 230%, the input. And what we had was two jars in electrical series where the current was the same through both. We had two voltmeters measure each of the voltages across each of the cell, the OMA control and the cold fusion cell. And what happened was that for less of a power, there was a greater temperature across the fusor. And so people watched that up to, I think we had 200 or 300 people during that Tuesday afternoon. Anyway, the pictures are at the website, and the people who wrote about it are there as well.
In all the experimentation that you've done, what would you say were the best results that you've been able to produce?
We've reported 270% excess, and we have shown engines that have gotten higher than that, and this is at the multi-watt level. And as I say, at recent colloquium, we showed some engines which went higher.
Okay. And that was at a demo, you say?
Which?
The colloquium?
That was an educational exercise where we, where afterwards we had a meeting of what we call the Lightning Club. Up here in the Northeast, we have a number of people who are very interested in electrostatic discharges. So we had, it was a multiple meeting.
Now, one of the things that we've not gotten into yet, you just alluded to it briefly earlier, and that is the role of this lattice-assisted nuclear reaction in medicine.
Well, I think there are two things. One, we don't know everything. I trained in radiation oncology, and we used to treat cancer of the stomach, and we did very well with radiation. We were able to get local and regional control, but today you use an antibiotic. So what does that tell us? We didn't know everything. And similarly, Semmelweis, who suggested to the early physicians that they wash their hands and ended up being imprisoned rather than listened to when he had statistical data showing that washing hands was a good thing. The more we know, the better it is. I'm also interested in powering artificial organs, and therefore you can see where that has an obvious overlap.
Now, that would be a constant energy output scenario, correct?
Exactly. Eventually, we will get these devices where we get electricity out. Already, we come to ICCF 14. And learn more about what we're doing. I hope you come in August.
Tell us the name of that conference again, and there's a website for that?
Yes. I will update the Cold Fusion Times, but if you look at ICCF14 for International Cold International Fusion. Committee on Coal Fusion, dash 14, or CM, I will get it for you. I will get you the website.
Okay, we can list it on our site on, under the Coal Fusion page. Yeah. Now, with the, you mentioned in an email that we had laser irradiation effects. Is that part of the medicinal application?
No, not necessarily. The back in 1989, we proposed irradiating the cathodes where the excess heat was. And one of the things that distinguishes our reports from others is rather than just show an effect, we have shown that there is an incremental photo-induced excess heat, for example, of about 90 milliwatts, resulting from only 3 milliwatts of incident optical beam. But what's interesting is the power gain is opposite the photothermoelectric response, because what we have found is the impact of light affects the solution in front of the metal. And in fact, there's much reflection. People are probably wrong about it getting in because they don't have the right angle and there's skin depth issues. And it's a little bit beyond here, but this is, I'm telling you, it's a wonderful physics. Your listeners have a great opportunity here. It's like the Louisiana Purchase.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about an output of 2.3, 2.7 times what the input is the operational scenario a self-feeding system with excess energy left over, or would you have a separate driving input to produce a separate output?
Well, you understand very quickly. I presented a paper approximately 5 years ago, maybe a little longer, in Gene Malov's magazine while he was still alive. Gene actually got to take part in one of our experiments. The recent issue in his magazine, I presented some of the data from that. And what we showed in that article in his magazine was that you need approximately five times the output continuously to get the electricity based on presently. That was our theoretical expectation at ICCF 14. We'll be showing how it experimentally compares with the theoretical.
So if you need five times the output and you're presently getting 2.3 to 2.7, the output to be self-running with energy left over, you're saying you have a ways yet to go in optimizing before it's a feasible, commercially plausible system?
Well, there is a race for electrical break-even. I believe that unlike hot fusion, we're already possibly at safe heat break-even, and electrical break-even's more complicated. The 2.7 was what we reported. We have gotten higher. Over the last year, we've gotten more than double that. And so there is hope. And all we got to do is keep working to make it happen, and we need more people.
When you talk about people, tell us about Jet Energy. How many people are involved in that process? Obviously you are. And who else?
We've had support from a lot of people. A lot of people. We've had, if you read our papers, we've even had paper support and help and ideas going back from Hal Fox at UTARG and Gail Verner, Jeff Driscoll, Alex Frank, Alan Weinberg, Aaron Kleiner, Peter Hagelstein, Brian Ahern, Larry, Stephen Olasky, lots of people who have helped us. And the result is, as I say, we have three theories that are really important that your listeners might want to take a look at. The quasi one-dimensional model of loading, the CAM theory, the fuson theory of how it finally couples to the lattice. They may want to look at our fusors and the optimal operating points.
And
the
you're
role
spelling
of
those P-H-U-S-O-R.
Yes, those are they're not to be confused with the fuson. A fuson is a quantum transfer, where what happens is the fusor is the device, that spiral that you show. You show a part of one of our devices at your web page. The fuson is a quantum transfer, a coherent transfer, because what happens is phonons have energies in the range of 30 to 40 milliev, and because the energy of the excited helium nucleus is 20 to 21 MeV, you need a recruitment of a lot of those phonons. And coherently, that's what the fuson is. That's the third theory. I'm sorry that they're similar names, but they both have a pH.
We have come to the end of our time here. I want to make sure people know where they can go for more information. We do have coverage of you at peswiki.com. That's PESWIKI.com. Just type in jet thermal or jet energy, and you'll pull up the page. Your website domain is a little bit involved.
We're going to change it, but in the meantime, they can get it through Google. And I want to tell you, Sterling, you do a really good job. Keep at it. And I think the American people are lucky that you're out there finding everybody's work and putting it up. I know how hard it is.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And it's been great having you on, Dr. Schwartz.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us. Take care.
You will.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's PESWIKI.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.